Katra Podcast Conversations for the Curious Essential Knowledge Simplified, your gateway to essential ideas that matter most.
Welcome to the Deep Dive. We're really thrilled you're joining us as we plunge into another one of those foundational texts.
Yeah, one that truly unpacks how our modern world really came to be.
Absolutely. Have you ever wondered why our current global landscape feels so, you know, fundamentally shaped by these twin forces of economics and politics, or why nationalism still holds such undeniable power today?
It's a great question. And today we're taking a deep dive into Eric Hobsbawm's monumental work, The Age of Revolution, 1789-1848.
Right.
And it's a book that doesn't just like list historical events. It really reveals the very moment these huge forces were forged.
The origin point.
Exactly. Setting the stage for pretty much everything that followed. It's like finding the origin story for so many of our present day challenges and systems.
Yeah.
It gives you this fresh lens to view everything, you know, from political divides you read about to the economic shifts happening right now. It truly is a remarkable work. One of those books that once you start engaging with it, you just see its influence everywhere.
Totally.
Hobsbawm basically gives us the operating manual for the modern world, doesn't he?
That's a great way to put it.
So who was the mind behind this sweeping analysis?
Well, Eric Hobsbawm, he lived from 1917 to 2012. He was arguably one of the most influential British historians of the 20th century.
Right. Cambridge educated.
Yep. Cambridge educated, taught for decades at Birkbeck, University of London.
Mm-hmm.
But what makes his perspective so distinctive and frankly so powerful is his background. He was a lifelong, albeit critical, Marxist.
Okay. And that Marxist lens, that's really crucial for understanding his work, isn't it?
Absolutely crucial. It means he wasn't just, you know, chronicling kings and battles, the great man view of history.
No.
He was looking at history from below, focusing on economic structures, class conflict, and these long-term material changes that he saw as the real drivers of historical shift.
Mm. The impact on ordinary people.
Exactly. He wanted to understand that, which gives his analysis, I think, a unique weight and depth.
And this approach is what allowed him to synthesize just vast amounts of information, right? Not just politics and economics.
Oh, everything. Art, science, social life. He pulls it all together into this panoramic global perspective.
Wow.
And The Age of Revolution was actually the first in his famous four-volume series on the modern world.
Yeah.
You know, followed by the Age of Capital, Empire, Extremes.
Right, the whole sweep.
Yeah. His ability to connect seemingly disparate events across continents, across disciplines, that's what makes his work still feel so relevant today.
Okay, so let's get into the heart of it then. What is the Age of Revolution actually about?
Okay, so at its core, Hobsbawm argues that this period, 1789 to 1848, it wasn't just a random collection of stuff happening.
No.
It was a dual revolution. That's his key phrase. He sees these two massive interconnected transformations starting in Britain and France, but their effects just radiated globally.
And fundamentally reshaped human society.
Fundamentally. He famously calls them the twin craters of a single larger volcano.
Twin craters. I like that image.
Yeah. So on one side, you have the British Industrial Revolution. That's the economic and technological explosion.
Mm-hmm.
Gave us the factory system, industrial capitalism, and these new social classes.
Right. The industrial bourgeoisie, the owners, and the urban proletariat, the workers.
Exactly. The wage earners. This was the material engine of change. The hardware, maybe.
Okay. The hardware. And the other crater.
That's the French Revolution.
Yeah.
The political and ideological upheaval. It just shattered the old aristocratic and monarchical order.
And introduce these radical new ideas, liberty, equality, fraternity.
All of that. Plus, the very concept of the nation state and this powerful modern force of nationalism. It was the political and ideological software, if you like, for the new world.
Software, okay. Hardware and software.
Yeah. And for Hobsbawm, you cannot understand one without the other. They're totally intertwined. That new capitalist economy needed the legal and political framework the French Revolution helped provide.
That makes sense. So the book takes you on this journey.
Right. From this largely rural, tradition-bound world of the 1780s, where power's all tied up with monarchs and landed aristocrats, and shows how, in just a few decades, he was utterly transformed into the factory-driven, capitalist, nation-state-dominated world of the 1840s.
It's a comprehensive analysis, then, of how these two forces didn't just change individual countries, but the whole global setup.
Absolutely. Land ownership, how people thought about themselves, their place in the world, everything.
Okay, let's unpack some of that incredible detail Hobsbawm provides. He He starts by painting this vivid picture of the world in the 1780s. What was that world really like?
Well, try to imagine it. Over four-fifths of people lived off the land. Agriculture.
Wow.
Power was held by absolute monarchs, landed aristocrats. News traveled, you know, at the speed of a horse or a ship. Slow, agrarian, hierarchical.
Pretty static, sounds like.
On the surface.
Maybe.
Yeah. But Hobsbawm shows us that beneath this surface, powerful forces were already stirring. You had colonial trade creating vast new wealth. Enlightenment ideas were challenging old authorities, questioning everything, and population growth was putting pressure on the existing systems.
So it was a world ripe for disruption.
Ripe for disruption, exactly. Even if most people living in it didn't see it coming.
And then bam, that first crater of the volcano, the British Industrial Revolution. Hobsbawm really zeroes in on Britain, doesn't he? Especially cotton.
He does. Places the heart squarely in Britain, the cotton industry. Driven by innovations like the spinning jenny, the power loom.
Stuff we learned about in school, maybe.
Yeah, but Hobsbawm stresses this wasn't just more growth. It was a radical change in kind.
How so?
It wasn't just bigger workshops. It was the birth of the factory system. This created entirely new urban landscapes. You know, the grim, smoky cities we picture.
Manchester, places like that.
Exactly. But teeming with life, too.
Yeah.
And, most importantly for Hobsbawm, it created a radically new social relationship.
Between
the capitalist owner, whose wealth comes from owning the means of production, and the free worker, who has nothing to sell but their labor, for wages.
Ah, okay, that's the core shift.
That's the core economic shift.
Yeah.
This new engine set the stage for all future industrial development, created unbelievable wealth, but also, you know, unbelievable social upheaval.
Which brings us to the other crater, the political side, the French Revolution. Hobsbawm sees this as just unparalleled, right? More radical than the American one. Even.
Far more radical, far more globally significant in his view. He sees it as a mass social revolution. It didn't just swap one elite for another. It completely overthrew monarchy and aristocracy.
And proclaimed individual citizen rights.
Yes. And he traces its phases with such incredible precision.
Right.
You know, from the moderate constitutional monarchy phase.
Right.
Through the really radical Jacobin Republic, which he sees as absolutely crucial for its innovations, despite the terror.
Okay, crucial how?
Well, think about things like the levy on mass universal conscription.
Right, the whole nation rising up.
Totally unthinkable before.
Mm-hmm.
Or the Committee of Public Safety, a kind of early form of state-directed social and economic engineering. For Hobsbawm, these weren't just events, they were inventions. Inventions of state power, of citizen mobilization, that would echo for centuries.
Shaping things like total war, maybe even the welfare state later on?
Exactly. It's in those details he shows the revolution's true transformative power, not just its famous slogans. And then, of course, you get the rise of Napoleon Bonaparte.
Who kind of consolidated it, but also exported it.
Precisely.
Yeah.
Which leads right into the Revolutionary Wars and Napoleon. From 1792 to 1815. And Hobsbawm argues these weren't just traditional wars between kings.
No. What were they?
They were total wars between entire social systems. The old order versus the new revolutionary one. French armies, fueled by this new ideology and mass conscription, they just redrew the map of Europe.
Literally redrew it.
Literally. And what's fascinating is Napoleon's paradoxical role. His conquests, kind of ironically, spread French legal and administrative models.
Like the Napoleonic Code.
Exactly, the Code Napoleon.
Yeah.
A standardized legal framework for property rights, individual liberty. It accelerated the modernization of the continent.
Even as Napoleon himself betrayed some revolutionary ideals by, you know, crowning himself emperor.
Right, so the revolution's ideas spread. Even when the leadership sort of faltered or changed, the genie was out of the bottle.
Speaking of which, after all that turmoil, they tried to put the genie back in at the Congress of Vienna in 1815, right? Peace was attempted.
Attempted, yes. They aimed to restore the old monarchical orders, create a balance of power. But Hobsbawm argues it was a really fragile peace, almost naive in a way.
Why fragile?
Because the forces unleashed liberalism, this new nationalism, industrial capitalism, they just couldn't be contained. You couldn't just pretend the previous 25 years hadn't happened.
Mm. The world had changed too much.
Fundamentally.
Yeah.
And this failure to contain these forces, it leads directly into the revolutions of the 1820s, the 1830s, and then that massive wave, the Springtime of the Peoples in 1848.
Right, revolutions popping up all over Europe.
All over. And Hobsbawm stresses, these weren't isolated incidents. They showed the persistent influence of the French model, this idea that people could rise up and demand change.
And the growing tension between the old guard and these new movements.
Exactly. Liberal movements, nationalist movements.
Mm-hmm.
They were direct consequences of the unresolved contradictions of that dual revolution.
Okay, so shifting to what Hobsbawm calls the results section, the world was profoundly changed. He talks about nationalism emerging in its modern form. Mm. What does that mean exactly? It's not just patriotism.
Yeah, you know, it's much deeper than that. Before this era, your identity was probably tied to your village, your religion, maybe your king or local lord.
Right, very local.
Very local or dynastic. But the French Revolution brought this idea of a people forming a sovereign nation. And when you combine that with a romantic movement, this powerful cultural ways emphasizing emotion, folk traditions, language, history, connection to the land.
Hmm.
It made nationalism an incredibly potent force. It wasn't just a political idea. It was an emotional cultural identity.
And it could both build nations and break empires.
Absolutely. It helped unify places like Germany and Italy later on. But it also started pulling apart the old multi-ethnic empires,
yeah,
like the Austrian and Ottoman empires. It literally invented the nation state as the sort of default political unit we think of today.
Wow. Okay. And the social transformations, you mentioned land ownership changing.
Dramatically. The old feudal obligation started to disappear. Land became more of a commodity, something to be bought and sold under capitalist rules.
And the impact on people?
Huge.
Yeah.
Landless peasants were often pushed off the land, forced into the rapidly growing cities to find work in the new factories. They became the proletariat.
Right.
But at the same time, you have that other principle from the French Revolution, the career open to talent.
Merit over birth.
Merit over birth, exactly. Aristocratic privilege based purely on who your parents were. That started to crumble. It was replaced by a new bourgeois society that valued wealth, education, hard work, you know, merit.
Creating this confident new middle class.
Very confident. Industrialists, bankers, lawyers, professionals, they saw themselves as the driving force of this new age, and they profoundly reshaped society in their image, their values.
But there's always the flip side, isn't there? The laboring poor.
And the flip side, indeed. Industrialization created the proletariat, and their conditions were often appalling.
Yeah.
Crowded into these grim urban slums, facing terrible exploitation, long hours, dangerous work, alienation. Hobsbawm doesn't shy away from describing the sheer misery. He recounts stories of child labor, the squalor of early factory towns. It's pretty brutal.
But it wasn't just misery, was it? He argues something else came out of that.
Yes, and this is crucial. He argues that this shared hardship, this common experience of exploitation, began to forge a new class consciousness.
An awareness of being a distinct group.
Exactly. A collective identity as workers. And this gave rise to the first early labor movements, trade unions, and socialist thought. These were direct reactions, attempts to challenge the new bourgeois order.
So the seeds of future conflict were sown right there.
Absolutely. The modern idea of a working class with its own interests and identity really solidifies in this period.
The book also dives into ideology and politics, right? How traditional religion's role changed.
Yeah, its authority declined significantly, at least in the public sphere for many. And that left a kind of vacuum, which was filled by these new secular ideologies.
This is where the modern political spectrum starts to take shape.
Pretty much. You see the rise of liberalism. That's the creed of the rising middle class.
Mm.
Individual rights, free markets, constitutional government, limited state intervention.
Okay.
And then in direct reaction and opposition, you get socialism, a response to capitalism's perceived injustices, advocating for cooperation, collective ownership, social equality.
And conservatism, too, presumably pushing back against all this change.
Oh, yes. Conservatism solidifies as a reaction against the revolution, trying to preserve traditional institutions and hierarchies. And nationalism, as we said, cutting across all of these sometimes.
So these weren't just abstract theories?
Not at all. They were lived realities, driving political movements, shaping laws, causing conflicts. Even the arts and sciences were transformed. Think of romanticism reflecting all this turmoil and emotion.
Right.
And science just flourishing, often intertwined with industry.
Huh.
And this powerful new idea of progress. These new ideologies literally created the political vocabulary we still use today. Left, right, liberal, socialist.
Yeah.
It all comes from here.
Okay, so if we boil it down, what are the really big takeaways from Hobsbawm's incredible analysis, the essential messages for us today?
Well, number one, the absolute master theme has to be the dual revolution itself. Hobsbawm is insistent. the British Industrial and French Political Revolutions were inseparable.
The hardware and the software.
Exactly. Two parts of a single monumental transformation. And the takeaway for us, maybe it's that any truly huge shift, think about AI today or climate change, probably needs both that technological or economic engine and a fundamental shift in our politics, our laws, our ideas.
Right. Technology alone doesn't reshape society without the political and ideological framework changing, too.
Precisely. They have to work together or clash spectacularly.
Okay, what else?
Well, linked to that is the triumph of the liberal bourgeoisie. This new middle-class industrialists, bankers, professionals, they were the primary winners of this era.
They came out on top.
They really did.
Oh.
They dismantled the old aristocratic order and championed liberalism, free market capitalism, constitutional government, ideologies that, frankly, serve their interests and reshape society in their image.
Which highlights how economic power can really drive political and social change, often for specific groups.
Definitely. But this triumph had a profound, often tragic, consequence.
Yeah.
The creation of the proletariat and class consciousness.
Right. The other side of the coin.
Industrial Revolution didn't just make stuff. Hmm. Hobsbawm argues its most significant product was this new class of wage laborers.
Mm.
And their shared experience of poverty and exploitation, it created that collective identity we talked about. It gave birth to labor movements, socialist ideas, forces that are still shaping debates about workers' rights, inequality, social safety nets today.
So those battle lines were drawn back then.
Many of them, yes. Another huge theme is the birth of modern ideologies.
Liberalism, socialism, conservatism, nationalism.
Exactly. The collapse of the old order left this void, and these new systems of belief rushed in to fill it. Hobsbawm shows how they all took their recognizably modern form in this period. He's basically showing us the origin story of the political language we still use.
When we talk about left and right, human rights, free markets, that vocabulary comes from this time.
It really does. He shows they didn't just appear out of thin air. They were forged in the heat of these revolutions.
And finally.
Finally, maybe the most potent force unleashed. The invention of nationalism.
Invention. That sounds strong.
Hobsbawm uses that kind of language because before this era, that idea of the nation state, a political entity based on a unified people with a shared language, culture, history, it just wasn't the dominant model.
Identity was local or religious?
Right. This idea was a radical invention of the era and became arguably the most powerful political force of the next two centuries. We still see it playing out constantly in identity politics, international relations, conflicts, everywhere.
Wow. Okay. Hobsbawm's writing, it's dense, but like you said, he has these moments of just perfect phrasing. What are some key ideas or quotes that really stick?
Well, his core statement, the one we keep coming back to, the 60 years between 1789 and 1848 were the era of a dual revolution, the primarily political French Revolution and the British Industrial Revolution.
Right.
And the key part, they were not two separate histories, but the twin craters of a single larger regional volcano whose eruption transformed the world.
That volcano image really drives home the interconnectedness. It wasn't just two things happening at once.
No, it was one massive event with two epicenters. Then, on the French Revolution's impact, this is powerful. The main result of the French Revolution was to put an end to aristocratic society. The career open to talent was its new guiding principle.
That shift from birth to merit, or at least the idea of merit, it's huge. Imagine a world where your potential was just strictly limited by your birthright. The revolution shattered that in principle.
In principle, yes. Though obviously not perfectly in practice.
Yeah.
He's also brutally honest about the Industrial Revolution. The Industrial Revolution created the ugliest world in which man has ever lived.
Wow. Ugly.
But it also created the most gigantic and powerful productive force in human history, which would eventually transform the lives of all.
That captures the paradox, doesn't it? The immense suffering alongside this unprecedented productive power. That tension.
That tension is central to Hobsbawm's analysis. Progress at a terrible cost, often.
And maybe one more. That summary of the two revolutions' roles.
Ah, yes. The hardware-software one. If the new economy of the 19th century was formed chiefly under the influence of the British Industrial Revolution, its politics and ideology were formed chiefly by the French.
Mm-hmm.
Britain provided the model for its railways and factories. France made its revolutions and gave it its ideas.
It's such a neat encapsulation, the material base and the ideological superstructure almost.
Exactly. A perfect way to visualize the two halves of this modern age being born.
So bringing it to today, why should you, listening now, care about revolutions from, you know, over 200 years ago?
Well, because Hobsbawm's work isn't just history. It's a powerful lens for understanding our world right now. The structures, the ideas born then, they still form the foundation of our global society.
Okay, like how? Give us some examples.
Okay, well, understanding modern politics, simple things. The terms left, center, and right. They literally came from where people sat in the French National Assembly.
No way.
Yes. And the core ideas, liberalism, socialism, conservatism, nationalism, that still drive our political debates, they all emerged, or took their modern shape, in this period. It helps explain why we argue about the things we argue about.
It gives you the historical roots of today's arguments.
Exactly. Or think about grasping global economics. This book explains the DNA of industrial capitalism. Why did concepts like liberty, nation, equality, they weren't just abstract words in books. They became material forces. They mobilized millions, toppled empires. It's a huge lesson in how ideology shapes history and how it continues to shape contemporary events. Ideas have real consequences.
Right. So ultimately, this dual revolution framework, it's something we can use today.
I think so. It provides a framework for analyzing change that you can apply to our own time.
Yeah.
Whether it's the digital revolution, the shift to a green economy, new social movements, it encourages you to look beneath the surface.
To look for those deep, interconnected economic and political forces at play, not just the headlines.
Exactly. Don't just look at the technology. Look at how it's changing power structures, laws, ideas, social relations.
So, wrapping up, what stood out most for you? What did you love about revisiting this?
For me, it's Hobsbawm's sheer ability to show that the world we live in isn't just there. It's not a given. It was actively constructed during this specific revolutionary period. Understanding that, understanding the deep structural roots of our present, it just makes you look at everything differently. You know, from the supply chain that brought you your coffee this morning to the political conflicts on the news, it's a profound paradigm shift.
Yeah, I get that. And what surprised me, or maybe struck me again, was the sheer scale of the transformation, but also its inherent contradictions.
Paradoxes.
Yeah. This era birthed immense wealth and opportunity, this idea of progress, right alongside immense poverty, exploitation, new forms of misery.
Ugliness, as he said.
Ugliness. And that tension, that contradiction, it feels like it still profoundly defines our world today, doesn't it?
It really does.
This book truly is a foundational text. It shows us that our present is just so deeply rooted in these tumultuous 60 years, and that maybe many of our modern problems are actually centuries old.
Well put. It's essential reading, really.
See you next time with another remarkable thinker, another powerful book, and another idea that has shaped our world. This audio summary is brought to you by Akatra Foundation.